Thank you for coming to this last final session of this challenging sutra. Let's see if we can finish off this exploration of the three lacks of own being in chapter 7 here. And in case I forget to mention, maybe you could, after class or just any time in the future, if you'd like to offer any feedback on this topic for this class, regarding the future, if you'd like to take up in a future year or some other time the continuing study of the Yogacara school, either continuing with the sutra, like there's a lot of great stuff even in chapter 7 that we're not going to get to, including chapter 8 and so on, or also the presentations of Asanga and Vasubandhu, who base their teachings on this sutra, or if you've had enough for this lifetime, you can let me know. So let's just go right into where we left off. Which was near the bottom of this first page. Please.
I remember that I was really doing pretty good with this stuff, and then right at the end, kind of near the end of the last class, when you got into this, or when we got into the part about the lack of own being, I lost my frame of reference. I really felt like we built a good frame of reference, first with the different consciousness, and then with the three characters.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's such a support structure for understanding this part.
I hope so.
Or how this relates to the other.
Oh, it totally relates.
But I would really appreciate whatever kind of real, basic, connective tissue you could offer.
Yeah.
That would be helpful.
Okay, so maybe I'll preface this before starting to read with something about that. And I think it will become more clear, too, as we read it. But so, as we recall, Chapter 5 was on the system of the eight consciousnesses, and in some ways we tried to map together a little bit the connection between the alaya storehouse consciousness and the other dependent character, and then the manas, the sense of the self, seventh consciousness, as the creator of this dualistic split that is, you know, correlated with the imputational character that uses words and language to impute or imagine an essence or own being or inherent existence in things. So there's some relationship between these, the consciousnesses that are the kind of like structure for how the mind is doing this, and then a more descriptive breakdown of phenomena in terms of these three characteristics. So they're related, right? Almost like the chapter 5 about the consciousnesses was like the ways that the mind works in order to create this illusion, and then chapter 6 about with the three characteristics or the three natures was about, a description of how the illusion is actually the illusion and the non-illusion. Right? The thoroughly established character is like the absence of illusion. That's why it's called. It's truly established as like reality. Now this chapter is very related. In fact, it's just a further continuation of chapter 6 because it's again on these three characteristics of all phenomena, but now it's looking at the way that each of these three lacks own being, or it's looking at the emptiness of essence in terms of each of these three characteristics. And in fact, it's equating them exactly and saying, what it, you know, we just started to get into the first one. It's like, you know, there's a lack of own being in terms of character. And that, what is that? It is the imputational character. So we'll explain this more today. But they're basically equivalent. These lacks of own being. Lacks of own being is lacks of self-nature, nisvabhava, absence of inherent existence, absence of essence, which is another way of talking about emptiness. But here they're calling it lacks of own being. And each of the three is each of the three characteristics, the imputational, the other dependent, and the thoroughly established, is a particular type of emptiness, as well as the way we were describing it first.
And that's what chapter 7
is? Yes.
The way that each of the characteristics of phenomena are also different kinds of emptiness.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So it's very connected to chapter 6 in particular. And it refers to these three characteristics again. And it's maybe, it's a, you know, if we're pretty grounded in understanding the relationship of the three characteristics, which we've been talking about a lot, we need to understand that first before we look at the three lacks of own being. But this is maybe even, that was kind of tricky, and this is maybe a little bit more hard to understand in a way. But hopefully if we get a sense for what those three characteristics are, it won't be that difficult to understand. So that's basically what this section of this chapter is, just defining these three. So we're at the part where the Buddha is saying, therefore, Paramartha Samugata, listen well, and I will explain to you what I was thinking when I said, all phenomena lack an own being. All phenomena are unproduced, unceasing, quiescent from the start, and naturally in a state of nirvana. Lack of own being in all the traditions of Buddhism is basically equivalent to this term emptiness. Shunyata, which is not going to appear in this chapter and hardly appears in this sutra at all, but it's exact same meaning. Lack of svabhava. Remember we talked about that term. Svabhava means self-nature or inherent existence or essence or substance. It's like that there's something intrinsic in things that makes them what they are. And that's what's being refuted or negated by emptiness. Nagarjuna is all about this term too. It's all about showing how things can't actually have an essence. And maybe just to remind ourselves again of what the context of all this, what's the point of emptiness and lack of own being. The proposal is that if we believe that things inherently exist and have an essence, we will be unable to resist grasping them with the mind. In order to truly let go and be completely at ease with the phenomenal world, we have to realize how things don't possess this essential existence. And we've talked about that before, and you know, that's a really important point, and maybe if there's time we could go into more if you can't remember that. But that point is that because things seem to have an essence, and that therefore we mentally adhere and grasp and attached to phenomena, mental phenomena, ideas about ourselves and others and the world, and physical phenomena, which this sutra is saying are actually really just mental phenomena anyway. So that's why emptiness is such a big deal in the Mahayana. And therefore, the Heart Sutra says, Avalokiteshvara clearly saw that all five skandhas that make up the entire world of experience, each of them is completely empty of an essence, and thus relieved all suffering, thus was free from all suffering, and because she's the Bodhisattva of great compassion, she by realizing this, she also relieved the suffering of all beings. It's a nice little thing about that, we're relieved. I mean, it's not so clear whether it's one's own or others, but in emptiness, no separation anyway. Relieved all suffering. So, when I said all phenomena lack own being, the Buddha says, because remember he's replying to this question about, Buddha, you said that there is suffering and there is a source of suffering and there's a path and there's five skandhas and you taught all these things, but then you said everything's empty and lacks own being. You sound like you're contradicting yourself. What do you mean? And Buddha says, thank you for asking. It's a great question. And now listen well, and I will explain. So Paramartha, thinking of three types of lack of own being of phenomena. So we're still talking about the same phenomena that have three characteristics. These same phenomena have three lacks of own being. And I might add here too that sometimes the three characteristics, later in this sutra actually, and also in a later tradition, are sometimes called the three natures. So this is a kind of dynamic thing because nature actually is svabhava. So there, it's kind of a funny thing, huh? That, and it's playing with words a little bit here and ideas to say that all phenomena have these three natures. But the English word nature kind of works there because things have an other dependent nature. That doesn't sound so solid, right? But yet it has the same word. They also, in the end, they have an absence of nature, meaning like a true inherent nature. So I think my understanding actually is that they, those are two slightly different nuances of this term svabhava. So like this book, which I recommend for if people want to get really into this Yogacara model and this thing about the three natures. It's very dense, but very thorough and covers every possible angle that you want to look at in terms of these three characteristics, called Reflections on Reality by Jeffrey Hopkins. And the subtitle is The Three Natures and Non-Natures in the Mind-Only School. So it's a whole, 600-page book on just on these three characteristics and the three lacks of own being. And based on Chapter 7 of this sutra that we're going over right now, and even just this section that we're just the sections we've read in this class are the basis for this entire book. So even though we've just been doing this for 8 weeks, you can see like you can go on and on with this, and all the arguments that we've been talking about, he gets into. This is actually part of a three-part trilogy. They're all about the same size by Jeffrey Hopkins. This is a little book advertisement here. The first one's actually just called Emptiness in the Mind-Only School, but also based on a same thing. He doesn't get, he touches on the eight consciousnesses, but it's really about these three natures and non-natures. Non-nature is lack of own being. And the third volume is called Absorption in No External World, and the subtitle is 170 Issues in Mind-Only Buddhism. So it's like these 170 questions that people like us might have about the three natures and non-natures, with and some pretty in-depth questions, and some of the ones we've actually asked in this class with elaborate answers. But the second volume, I think, if you actually wanted to get into this, my favorite is this second middle, Reflections on Reality, that it's just a good overview. Okay. Now, that was a word from our sponsor, Natalie. Back to thinking of three types of lack of own being, of phenomena. The lack of own being in terms of character, we're just going to name them now. The lack of own being in terms of production, and ultimate lack of own being. I taught all phenomena lack own being. And it's three types. You just named them so far, don't worry, if it doesn't make any sense. So now, Paramartha Samugata, what is the lack of own being in terms of character of phenomena? So this word character is actually lakshana, the same word as the three characters or three characteristics. So there's some interesting word stuff going on here too.
Lakshana
means mark or characteristic, and in the sutra, the three characteristics of all phenomena is tri lakshana, the three characteristics. So what is the lack of own being in terms of character or characteristics? It is the imputational character or characteristic. I'll just read the description. Why is this? The imputational character is a character posited as names and symbols, but it does not subsist by way of its own character. Therefore, it is the lack of own being in terms of character. So, remember the definition of the imputational character. It's
words and symbols.
That are used to attribute an essence and attributes to phenomena, or an own being and attributes of phenomena, in order to designate conventional phenomena. So it's using words, to say book, and then when we use the word book applied to something here, we at the same time attribute an essential like bookness to it. It's the way that words connect with the signs of some inconceivable bright pearl appearance here, and as soon as the word lands on that, this vast inconceivable aspect of brightness just becomes like a book, this limited book with it, and that's what we mean by like an essence of a book. It's like has bookness. Now we might think, well, we don't really think that this has bookness, but the proposal is that we do perceive this way from birth. All sentient beings relate to things as if they were like there in more than this illusory way, that they're substantially there. So what does essence or own being or substance means is worth exploring in detail. We don't have time to go into that so much, but it's worth thinking about, well, how do we actually, what kind of essence do we actually, are we perceiving here? And do we really? And examine our own experience to see if we can tell how we're actually attributing essences to basically everything continuously. So so that imputational character, it's only posited by names and symbols. It doesn't subsist by way of its own character. It's just, remember in chapter 6, it was like, the metaphors were like the, like an eye disease, right, that creates these illusions. It's like this, this mechanism by which we see things as real when they're not really real. In the mirage image, there is the other dependent appearance of water in the desert, but it's not really water, but we impute, when we see that, we actually think that really is water. So that's the imputational character, is like the actual water. It doesn't exist, right? So it has no character of its own. The water has no characteristics of its own, right? It's just a complete illusion. It's like completely imagination. Hare Kalpata means complete imagination.
I have an example. I think it may be an example. It's a true story. In 1972, I worked at the Grand Canyon near Flagstaff. And there was a program to relieve old Native Americans of the burden of having to tend sheep and spin wool and things like this. And so they took away this old woman's sheep and gave her Social Security checks because she couldn't work. That was the rule. They came back and they found her frozen in her hogan, and she'd been burning her checks. The imputation of the checks had never been transmitted to her.
She was using them for warmth.
She was burning them for warmth. She'd exhausted everything that she had stored up. There's an example, no inherent exit. You know, we look upon this and say, of course, this is a livelihood. This is this piece of paper is your livelihood now. That was never transmitted. She just saw it as fuel.
Yeah, we impute different things to that piece of paper.
And the Social Security Administration said, of course, this is a livelihood. That's what it is. But it wasn't for her.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, both the livelihood and the check were both imputed in different ways, just like fish and humans see water differently. That's a nice example, mind-only example of different imputations upon the same other dependent phenomena of this, like, what we call sometimes a piece of paper with numbers on it. So, can you see how the imputational character lacks an essence in terms of character? Like, it has no characteristics, actually. And the reason that's being singled out here is because other dependent phenomena, like the mirage of water, in a way, it kind of has characteristics. It appears as it has the appearance of a mirage. That's its characteristic. But the actual water, this helps to clarify the difference now between these two. The actual water doesn't exist in the slightest way, right? That actual water has no characteristics whatsoever. And that's what we mean by the imputational character. Does that make sense?
I
Doesn't?
I have another example. Not the actual water is the imputational character,
yes.
And the mirage is the other thing.
Yes. Because other
actual water in a mirage.
Yeah.
The actual water.
We're looking at this mirage of water, and we really believe that it's water when we see it. We say that really is water, and we perceive it as water. That's what's meant by the imputation.
Yeah.
Mind creates water.
Yeah.
Mind creates water.
Water where it's not really water. But it appears as water. Now, maybe one of my favorite metaphors for these three characteristics, the mirage, because the other dependent characters talked about like an appearance, which doesn't mean that there's nothing happening, right? It's not like there's no water and it just like goes blank. No, it still appears as water, but it's not really water. It's really not. Like when we go up close to it, then it actually disappears completely. Which is kind of a nice part of it too. We get really close to the appearance, even the appearance ceases. But so in terms of that image, the actual real water, and that's like the essence of the water, like substantially existing water has no characteristics of its own. And that's the way that the water is empty of own being. The way the water lacks own being is in this particular way. It lacks own being in terms of characteristics. I think in a way this might be the easiest one to see because it's just like, it's obviously empty of substance, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously our imputations are completely empty. They're called complete imagination. There's nothing to them at all. But that's not the whole story, right? That's just one characteristic of phenomena. There's also the other dependent that also lacks own being, but in a different way. So, want to hear about that?
Yeah. Betcha.
Yes.
There's three. I don't want to only get three.
Oh.
I got something here that's been spinning around my mind, so trying to fit it into this. Is, I recently had pneumonia.
Yes.
You know, you saw me in the hospital.
Yes.
They took an x-ray. there's a, some image on them, and doctors did that, and they give me antibiotics and all this other stuff. You heard me cough. What's getting imputed there? Or what's, you know, where's the...
The pneumonia is a phenomena, right? So pneumonia has three it's a phenomena with three characteristics.
Yeah.
All phenomena have all three. So pneumonia has this other dependent character that means like there's all these causes and conditions come together in order to create this appearance in a momentary way that maybe many, many moments for a month of like bright pearl something. But before we name it, we can't say. But it's a miracle. And then we name it pneumonia. And when we name it pneumonia, then it becomes like not just this like temporary appearance of a bunch of conditions lined up just so that actually. It appears in a certain way, but now it actually, it's actually pneumonia, and of course, that's the way we usually think. The idea with imputation, it's not just something we do in extreme situations, it's continuous, or every phenomena, every experience has an as long as this is an experience, it has an imputational character.
Because the doctor wrote on a piece of paper, pneumonia.
Yeah.
That's when I got pneumonia. Before that, I was just coughing.
Yeah. I think that's true. And we could also say, before he wrote pneumonia on the paper, we're still attributing some other substance, like sick, not well, from the very first cough. So it's not like, you know, then it was a different experience. That was an unnamed disease. And then it became, you're right though, it became pneumonia.
As soon as you did that, all this other stuff started happening.
Yeah, but when anybody calls it that, even if you don't write it on a piece of paper, as long as we like think that something is actually there, even with that slight bit before we can even name it, like another name would be, a body issue. Even before we call it sickness, there's something happening in the body here. It's like already that has an essence of something in the body. And as you can see, one thing that nicely proves that things lack this imputed essence is because they change from just a body thing into pneumonia. You could say, well, pneumonia is kind of a type of body thing, but sometimes we say health, and then we like realize later that wasn't health, that was sickness. So things don't have these fixed natures, and they're other dependent. Mm-hmm.
And also with the pneumonia, isn't it? It's really the dependent co-arising of a number of things at the same time due to causes and conditions. So there are. There's whatever causes, like some bacteria, there's fluid, there are lungs, and when they all show up in the same place at the same time, we call it pneumonia.
Yeah.
And then the name and the physician, mm-hmm. and the diagnosis,
all those are part of the other dependent, but also to mention that in this mind-only school, the other dependent is particularly, and dependent co-arising itself is particularly nuanced in this mind-oriented way. So that's why we're saying that the storehouse consciousness could even be said to be another name for dependent co-arising. All of these conditions that you were just talking about are dispositions of our particular mind. That makes it even more radical. But if that seems like, then we start to lose the whole story here. We can put that aside for now, but that's what makes the whole system fit together as one complete whole too, is that all those conditions are actually like, the mind's stored up dispositions for conceptualizing, doctors and hospitals and sicknesses, and all those things are also concepts. that come together in particular ways to create new concepts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Neurologically, I believe it's fair to say that the brain does not notice what isn't changing. And so the brain becomes aware of impermanence. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes aware of all the relationships, the causes and conditions that are creating this form of impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's given a name at that point, and it becomes something which is kind of like a fixed thing. The imputation, the one, and the other dependent. And yet it's limited.
Mm-hmm.
It's limited. And so we get to the thoroughly established, which is not limited. And we say, if it's limited, that implies no limits. So that's how all three of them come about. So I've heard this said by, you know, I counsel addicts and alcoholics, and I was talking to one who's been drunk, just a troublesome drunk, and I says, you've got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous to catch alcoholism. There is a thing that can get better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to. It's a nice imputation to make.
There's a whole relationship and fixation. You know, you can go there and you can get better from that thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not that imputation, we should eliminate, even if we could, which is impossible, eliminate imputations. They're very useful. Yeah. Very useful. Yeah. Like for buying redwood and for everything we basically do. We need to do. But then to just see how the imputational is not superimposed on the other dependent, right in the midst of using it, even.
Well, it's a way of navigating impermanence, really.
Yeah, navigating impermanence in a way that doesn't stick to things as much. Okay, so they, again, this is one more time on that one. The lack of own being in terms of character phenomena, it is the imputational character. So that's, they're actually completely equivalent. The lack of own being in terms of character is another name for the imputational character. Right? That's kind of neat too. Direct equivalence. It's not like, we could say that the imputational character lacks own being in terms of character, but if we're talking about, it is a type of emptiness also. It is the lack of own being or emptiness in terms of character. Like, they're equivalents. So the three natures and the three non-natures are exactly the same thing. They're just these two different sides of one thing. One nature, non-nature. So why is this? The imputational character is a character posited as names and symbols, but does not subsist by way of its own character. It doesn't have any characteristics of its own. It is it's a purely mental image. Now, Paramartha Samagata, what's the lack of own being in terms of production of phenomena? It is the other dependent character of phenomena. Why is this? The other dependent character arises through the force of other conditions and not by itself. Therefore, it's the lack of own being in terms of production. And there may be different ways to look at this, but I think the simplest way to talk about it is if you put a self dash in front of production, I think this makes it make a lot more sense. It's a lack of own being in terms of self-production. And then it says there, because it doesn't produce itself. Other dependent things do not produce themselves. Mm-hmm. They're produced by other things. Mm-hmm. The other dependent character of pneumonia, as we talked about, it's not like pneumonia suddenly makes itself, like out of the blue, right? It just, all it is the coming together of these different conditions, like germs and lungs and however else it works, and, you know, and concepts also. it doesn't produce itself. So that's the kind of emptiness, right? That's maybe the kind that we're maybe most familiar with when we think about emptiness. We think of, well, things are interdependent, therefore they lack own being. It's maybe the simplest way to think about it. Dependent co-arising things don't produce themselves, therefore they lack own being in terms of self-production. Nothing makes itself. Does that seem clear? Mm-hmm. Seems maybe easier so far, but we're going to see some startling thing next about this that makes it not so simple here. Now, Paramarthasamagata, what is an ultimate lack of own being of phenomena? Phenomena that are dependently originated lack an own being due to the lack of own being in terms of production. So that's what we just heard. That's just a repetition of the previous sentence, right? Phenomena that are dependently originated means other dependent phenomena. They lack an own being due to the lack of own being in terms of production. It's just a restatement of what we just said. They also, other dependent phenomena, also lack own being due to an ultimate lack of own being. Why is this? Paramarthasamagata, I teach that whatever is an object of observation for purification of phenomena is the ultimate. Since the other dependent character is not an object of observation for purification, it is an ultimate lack of own being. Okay, so.
Okay, slow this bit down.
I think this is maybe the hardest part of this chapter, or the part, at least this section we're reading. And it's kind of playing with words, and I think the Buddha could have done this in some other way, maybe, but. This is how it turned out. And it got, you know, in here you can find many different interpretations of people defending why the Buddha said it this way, and so on. Yeah, in a way, it's all about loosening the grip. But it's a very interesting point being made here, and it's this point that I keep trying to bring up in Sashin. I was bringing up the last time too, and we keep falling into this idea of. That sounds like if you have the other dependent character, if you have dependent co-arising, and you just remove the imputational character, then that other dependent is the thoroughly established. Right? Some people might have thought such a thing, right? Mm-hmm. We've talked about that, and I maybe tried to explain in vain how, no, it's not quite the same. And this is what this is about, actually, now.
Are you going to tell me the thing about the hand?
The hat?
The space.
Oh, the space in the hand.
That works.
We can try that. Okay.
Try that one.
This might be a good time for the hand thing.
Yeah, both of them.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Okay, so it's like one image of the, about the clear crystal one, right? About this overlay. So this is like this color. This is the clear crystal in front here. And then there's a color, blue, that we put behind the crystal. And then from your side, you see this as like turquoise or something. Do you remember that one? Mm-hmm. And that's the illusion that's created when the imputational, that's the color blue, is strongly adheres to the other dependent, which is this clear crystal. And then it's taken to be this real turquoise. Whereas actually it's just, the turquoise is just an illusion, like a mirage. It really appears as turquoise, just like a mirage really appears, but it's not turquoise. All these metaphors are just metaphors, so they're a little rough, but it's a pretty nice one. And now the thoroughly established is the, defined as, in some places anyway, I think the most clear definition is, it's the absence of the imputational in the other dependent, or the absence of the imputational on the other dependent, or the absence, the absence of strong adherence to, you know, strong adherence of the imputational to the other dependent. When these two seem to be like kind of laminated together, like the same thing, we then believe this illusion of turquoise-ness. Right, so, but they're not actually stuck together. They don't strongly adhere. So this thing, which I credit Tenzin Roshi with this hand thing, is that when you look this way, you turn them this way, or more like they're like this, and you have to kind of meditatively kind of like it like this.
Right.
And you look and you see how it's they're not strongly adhered. The imputational is not the other dependent. Mm-hmm. There's space between them, and that way that they're not adhered, like this, which we could kind of say is the space between them is the thoroughly established character. You follow that? It's like the absence. It's a space. It's an absence of this being in this. So it's not so much that that we remove this and now this is thoroughly established. No, so they're both here, and it's just the way that they're not the same thing is another way to say it. That's the thoroughly established. And we might say, but that's so abstract. Why are you calling that the thoroughly established? But that is like the emptiness. That's the way, and another, and, you know, maybe Zen way to say this is like, I'm always clearly aware and words don't reach it. Right? They don't reach it. There are still words. Mm-hmm. I'm clearly aware, and there's all these words like, I think I'm not so aware today, or I'm very aware today. But all these words don't reach the actual awareness. And the one about, you know, it's not that there's no practice in realization. It's just that they can't be defiled by this. And then the sixth ancestor says, this non-defilement is what's realized by all the Buddhas and ancestors. This is kind of like the non-defilement, that this doesn't defile this. It's not so much that the practice and realization is what's maintained by all the Buddhas. It's the non-defilement of practice and realization by, our ideas about it, basically. In that story, they don't say what the defilement is, but the, you know, they can't be defiled by calling them practice and realization or anything else. And the other example was about the hat, the hatless person, maybe we brought up in class before. It's like, there's a person wearing a hat, so the person's like the other dependent character. And that, you could do this with any objects, right? But the hat is like an imputational character. Now, you can remove the hat, and then you have this hatless person that's like a pure other dependent character without the imputational. And we might think, that's cool. Now we just, like, let's look at the hatless person. Isn't that going to purify us, our consciousness of illusion, just looking at this pure dependent co-arising? But no. We actually don't look at the hatless person, look at the absence of the hat. Like, look at like that space above the top of the head where there was a hat. Again, sounds quite abstract. That's why meditation on emptiness is an incredibly subtle thing, because you're like, it's a pretty conceptual thing on the surface at first. It's like looking at the way that our ideas don't actually connect with what's happening. Mm. The way that they don't connect, you know, it's very hard to focus on because it's not a thing. It's an absence. It's a lack. That's why it's called emptiness. And it's a little different than dependent co-arising. We're calling the other dependent character dependent co-arising, and then the thoroughly established is the emptiness or the lack of the imputational in it. So two different meditations. Meditating on dependent co-arising is also really great. and the Buddha talks about, first I teach bodhisattvas to meditate on dependent co-arising, and then they start to see that they're not in control, and that things are not self-produced, including themselves. They're produced from others, and they kind of sober up. I think he says later in this chapter, they become disillusioned with samsara. But it's not the whole story. Then, when they kind of sober up a little bit, then I teach them these other two characters, and he says they meditate. I teach them to meditate on the imputation of character, the way that they think, now I'm sobered up. Like, that's just the attribution of, that's not really what I am. And then even more subtle, the way that the idea of being sobered up doesn't reach what's actually happening. So, you could say this is...
So, I feel asymmetry here. I'd like just to ask about this.
Asymmetry.
Mm-hmm. Asymmetry, yeah. There's one side of the symmetry is this other dependent without imputation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have this third thing that shows up. But is it possible also to have an imputation without dependent other? And I'm thinking specifically of an ideal. Something like that.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Yes, and you can just point out the fact that there are they call existent imputational characters. Now, the one that the sutra is bringing up is a completely non-existent imputational character, but there are in the system of Buddha Dharma, there are existent, you know, we could say conventionally existent imputational characters. We won't go into how they exist, but one of them is space. It's the classic example. Space meaning like the absence of things in the room. And we're not talking about like the oxygen or, you know, but completely empty space. It's an imputation. We can't actually see it. It's a mental idea, but it doesn't have an other dependent character.
Right.
That's the thing. Space doesn't arise. So it's a kind of weird example. And when I thought about it, similar to what you said, I thought of mathematical formulas.
Yes. Imaginary numbers.
Which you said imaginary numbers, yeah. Because they're like, They're a mental construction, that doesn't have like a basis in the other dependent world. So yeah, the system does deal with existent imputational characters, but the ones the sutra is talking about in this case are this particular non-existent one that's the attribution of essences and things.
So we can just say, it's an asymmetrical presentation. It doesn't say that the model is asymmetrical. This does not deal with that. We can incorporate with the mind only something like the imputational absent the
other. I think a way to say it is, this is talking about a particular type of imputational character, and you could say it's the... It's like 99.9% of all imputational characters are this imaginary one, because every thought we're having is one of them. But then there's a few occasional existent ones, like when we happen to posit space or an imaginary number.
Because it's not just a kind of abstract thing, because I believe what I'm talking about has real effects in the world. Like when I believe I can read your mind and project things on you that are not in your mind, and then argue about how you're wrong. Mm. I mean, this happens between husbands and wives.
Uh-huh.
It causes big suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real thing.
The imputation.
The imputation without the other man. Projection of somebody's internal state on somebody else is a pure application of an ideal, even though it's not fun, on something it doesn't have evidence at all. There's no real dependent, other dependent there.
Yeah. Although we could say there's the person doing that is sees some basis for doing it, they can perceive some other dependent thing that maybe the other person doesn't, right?
They're creating something out of nothing.
I don't know if it's out of complete nothing, though, because, you know, they probably wouldn't, they usually don't randomly make up those stories. Sometimes they might, but if it's like a spousal argument, it's usually like they start perceiving this person's doing things in a certain way that that they don't like, but the other person doesn't see themselves doing it in that way. But this person actually is attributing it to some other dependent occurrence. It's not completely out of the blue, you know, like completely random.
Out of the blue with respect to the other person that's projecting on. I mean, that person has no participation at all in this fantasy.
Yeah.
Being slammed.
But that's just goes to show how the other dependent is ungraspable and like water for a fish and humans. It's not. It's no. We can't say that one's more right than the other. And that's how arguments happen. How could you not see it my way? How could you not see it my way? Okay, so... Yes. Oh, yes.
Subtle meditation. We can meditate on other dependent, and we can meditate on the absence of the imputational. Is there... a success in that meditation? Do you actually grasp something? Do you get something? Is there something to grasp?
Well, of course not, right?
But
the result is that the funny thing about, you know, meditation on emptiness sounds like you're focusing on something, but it's emptiness, right? Well, there's like you're focusing on this particular absence, though, and that's why we also got into this discussion of, or do I just let it go of all thought?
Not if you're looking for it.
You find the absence in relation to the other two characters, so. Particularly about the you watch exactly where how you're imputing. It's not in some ethereal kind of way. It's right there at the imputation. So like, oh, okay. So like an example. So we're sitting zazen. Okay, we take the body. You could take any, and I think it's really good to take you know, directly experienced objects of the present moment instead of. I mean, we can do these examples about mirages and stuff are nice. But to take something in our experience makes it very here and now. So like there's the body, and then we start contemplating first the way, in a kind of conceptual way, how it doesn't create itself. And we can see how it is in other dependent phenomena. Already, if we do that for a while, we start to become disillusioned with the way that we usually see the body, right? It's like, oh, it's not what I think it is. It's like, and it's not in my control, obviously, because I would, if it was, I would decide not to have pneumonia. And I can't just do that. So that's part of it. And then we start to see how, then we go to the next character. It'll be like, now I'm seeing how I actually think it's a body, and, you know, with names, but even if we get more subtle than the actual, like, having to say the word body. I think that it's like, you know, that it substantially exists outside the mind. This would be another part. The imputation is that of duality, the imputation that objects exist external to the mind. So it's like, if I look down at the body, it seems like you can pretty easily start to see how it seems like actually there's mind, and then there's like there's the body that I'm looking at. And if you start to try to look at your nose or something, it gets trickier. But there does seem to be, even though in another sense it's all one experience, we often relate to the body as like an object, like this is my hand. Well, whose hand? That, like the mind's hand, right? When we say my hand, or you could, yeah, we might mean that's the body's hand, but actually, I think there's a subtle sense that, like, when we say my hand or my body, that we're, the my that's the subject of that is some sense of, like, the mind, usually, I think. We don't break it down this way, but we can start to examine how we do that. And then and then start to see how that doesn't hold up. Basically, the thoroughly established part is to see how the idea, my body, doesn't really adhere to this other dependent arising of this miraculous appearance of stuff like here. Or, as the sutra says, in the absence, how do we know the thoroughly established character? In the absence of strong adherence to the other dependent character as being the imputational character, the thoroughly established character is known. How do we know the other dependent character? How do we know it? So this gets into this thing of like, in order to know it and understand it, we know it by strongly adhering to it as being the imputational character. I know the body. This is the body. That's because we know it by strongly adhering to it as the body. And so to not do that is this very subtle thing. But so it's not just like, this thing of, well, just let go of all thought and just relax. In a way, that is kind of going into the thoroughly established character, because we're not the there aren't particular imputations that are creating things, and that's why Zazen is so nice and relaxing, and problems temporarily are not there. But then, but to see how this particular to see it right in, like in the midst of a thought, for example, that thought doesn't reach the experience. And then, and therefore, then let go of the thought, or like then the thought like has no, it doesn't have as much energy to do its thing anymore. Its thing of like, you know, defining our world. So instead of like just try to let go of thoughts, then it's more like, this may be a more difficult approach, but it's like maybe you could, if we get right at that place where the thoughts are making things, then we see like, oh, it doesn't really make. I see how I'm just like creating illusion all the time, and like let me just relax from doing that. It's a little bit different than just okay, just try to relax and let go of thought.
Yeah.
How about that for the difference? Yeah.
So isn't the short answer cessation of suffering?
What? This is the
short answer is cessation of suffering. Isn't that really what happened?
Oh, that's the point of meditating on the thoroughly established is, at that time, or realizing emptiness is realizing how suffering ceases. But there's a nice part in here that I happened to come across, too. Even though it's necessary, A little thing about this point, this little section called realization of the ultimate truth is not the final goal. Despite the emphasis on the tenet that the thoroughly established nature is a mere emptiness or absence, this does not mean that the goal of practice is either a mere negative or cognition of a mere absence. Similarly, that the ultimate truth is a mere absence does not mean that the goal, so it is saying it is a mere absence, the ultimate truth, but it doesn't mean that the goal of the practice is a mere absence or realization of a mere absence. Rather, the ultimate truth is the final nature of what exists, because the terms ultimate truth and thoroughly established nature seem to suggest that only it finally exists. And because the term conventional truth seems to suggest that objects such as tables and books exist only for an ignorant person, or at least highly provisional consciousness, it's understandable that many people have mistakenly drawn the conclusion that the doctrine of Mahayana Buddhism is excessively negative, unable to affirm the existence of anything except emptiness, which they take to be nothingness. So it goes on to say, even though emptiness is an absence here, and it's totally necessary, as the Buddha will say in the sutra, to realize that the path of seeing, I mean, it's like enlightenment, actually. But enlightenment's not the final goal. it depends how we're defining enlightenment. If it's like direct insight into emptiness, it's totally necessary, but it's not the end of the matter. How does he say? This does not mean that objects other than emptiness exist only for ignorance and therefore do not actually exist. Rather, the truthness of such objects, their existing in the way that they appear, is posited only by ignorance. A consciousness concealing the way things actually exist. And this truthness, I think truthness is another way of saying inherent existence. This truthness does not exist at all. The basis of division into two truths is objects of knowledge. Hence, both ultimate truths and conventional truths exist, although only ultimate truths are actual truths in that they exist in the way they appear in direct realization. Therefore, that emptiness is called the ultimate truth. I think this is what he's saying. Is when we say ultimate truth, it sounds like it's the ultimate final goal of the path. It's just the ultimate truth. It does not in any way imply, although it admittedly seems so from the words, that the final state of like Buddhahood is mere cognition of emptiness. The final state is a union of pure body and pure speech, unendingly and spontaneously bringing about the advancement of other beings. Mm-hmm. Wow. Just compassion. Nice wording too, huh? Emptiness, the thoroughly established nature, is called the ultimate object because of being the object of a consciousness of meditative equipoise on reality and because of being the ultimate nature of objects. It's interesting that it's an object. It's an object of meditation for purification of delusion. But it's not ultimate in the sense that mere realization of it is the final state. Rather, the ultimate goal is to have a combination of direct realization of emptiness and direct comprehension of all conventional objects in order to be of service to others. Mm-hmm. Thus, emptiness is the essence of the Buddha's teachings in the sense that through realization of it, altruistic aims can be achieved as they could not otherwise be. He doesn't explain that so detailed.
But. That's what we were saying also, that the realization of emptiness is the first of 10 Buddhas.
Exactly. Right. It's the beginning of the Bodhisattva path. And the Buddha, in this sutra, the Buddha has a nice description too of, I think it was, we already read it in chapter 6. It is, he says, this is suchness, and it's what establishes all the stages up to complete perfect enlightenment, the thoroughly established. So then there's all these bodhisattva stages of like basically integrating ultimate and conventional truth is how it was put there. Like we're living in this apparent world, but we're not believing it in the same way. It's like a dream-like world, but then we're like, but the whole point is like liberating all beings from suffering. So must remember, yes.
I just think this is so important, you know, and because we do tend to, and popular culture does tend to, make it sound like the goal is this kind of, you know, peaceful place where you're just this perfect purity and, you know, all that whole thing. And it's so not that.
Well, in a way, I might say that, like he said there, right, perfectly pure body and speech as a Buddha or like a high-level bodhisattva, where for that being, they are like, they don't suffer actually anymore. But they're living in this world, I mean, at some, you know, later stages in the practice. But they're living for the benefit of all these suffering beings.
Yeah, I mean, the point to me is that where we live is the interface of the ultimate and the relative. And mm-hmm. that we're liberated by understanding that the ultimate, but where we live and where our people live and the people with whom we practice is in the relative. And so,
well, we live in both.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But I mean, it's not helpful to just preach emptiness to people
no,
who are, I mean, it's useful if there's a context, and if
we need the context.
That would be helpful.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, like a fellow practitioner who you know has some context for it, and you
mm-hmm.
we can talk about it as a way to liberate ourselves from fixed views.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to show up in action
mm-hmm.
if it's to be of service in the world. So you may be coming, or one may, a bodhisattva may be coming from an understanding of the ultimate, but the actions
yeah.
show up
yeah.
in this
yeah.
non-rarefied
yeah.
zone.
It's totally important, and we could talk about that a lot, but there's so much to be said about emptiness too. And in a way, I think I have the faith that that if we, the more we truly understand what emptiness and the thoroughly established nature is, that all takes care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, but if we don't really understand it, or we start using the concepts in this
mm-hmm.
way, a self-serving way,
mm-hmm.
then we're in trouble. That's why it's dangerous teachings in a kind of way. But I think that, yeah, that's like, you know, emptiness sickness and stuff. It's like, it's actually not understanding emptiness. You can't really get sick from actual emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
But a misunderstanding of it sounds like nihilistic, or that there's nothing and nothing matters and so on. So, yeah.
This is the essence of the Heart Sutra. In form there is emptiness, and emptiness there is form.
Mm-hmm.
According to Durant's unity, in light there is darkness, and darkness there is light.
They're not separate.
Yeah, and the heresy that I think Kathy's alluding to is just, I just don't know. There's nothing to know, no. But actuality, I don't know is only present in the context of I know.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So, the other heresy is saying, all it is what I know. So being able to live in a place in that scene and say, I know, and I don't know, that is like with a koan. That's mm-hmm. the space of the koan. And that is
what's it have to do with understanding, and how do you understand?
Yeah, yes, that's the koan. And so it's very relieving to be able to be released from my certainty that the way I have seen things and defined them is the way it is. Say, well, you know, that is one of the glints of the gem. Just one of them. It's, how about the rest?
Hmm.
It's just an existentially relieving technique.
Mm-hmm. And difficult to understand, which is why as you know, according to this presentation, it's a very subtle thing, and but this sutra, I think, does such a great job of explaining it in a way that,
mm-hmm.
more than the Heart Sutra, maybe,
mm-hmm.
It's actually getting into how exactly is the mind creating illusion and freeing from illusion. So please let me continue with this so we can get through these three lacks of own being. So going back to that part now, what's the lack of own being in terms of... Oh, no. Now we're at... What's an ultimate lack of own being? Phenomena that are dependently originated, the other dependent, lack own being due to the lack of own being in terms of production. They also lack own being due to an ultimate lack of own being. So this is I take it as kind of a word play here. They lack own being... due to ultimately lacking own being, or they lack own being in terms of the ultimate. Right? Other dependent characters lack own being in terms of the ultimate. That's an ultimate lack of own being. They lack the nature of the ultimate. Now, you might not get that from the translation, but let's just... take it as that's what's being said here. It's funny language, and you can read a lot of commentaries on how, why the language is constructed like that, but that seems to be the point that the Buddha is making, just so that we don't take meditating on dependent co-arising as the final
mm-hmm.
thing, because it's kind of easier, and he's saying this is not, it actually, other dependent things lack the own being of ultimate truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. Therefore, he's saying there's two types of ultimate lack of own being.
Mm-hmm.
The first is the other dependent,
mm-hmm.
but then we might first hear that and be, oh, that cool, the other dependent and thoroughly established are both ultimate. But then you hear that I teach that whatever is an object of observation for purification of phenomena, means purifying phenomena from our delusions of them, is the ultimate, since the other dependent character is not an object of observation for purification. It's an ultimate lack of own being. That's the sentence that makes it clear. The other dependent character is not the object of observation for purification. Therefore, it lacks the nature of the ultimate truth. And then lastly, moreover, Paramarthasamugata, the thoroughly established character of phenomena, is also an ultimate lack of own being. Why is this? Paramarthasamugata, that which is the selflessness of phenomena, is known as their lack of own being. That is the ultimate, the selflessness, the absence of inherently existent self. Let's bring in another term there. Since the ultimate is distinguished as the lack of own being of all phenomena, it is an ultimate lack of own being. So, and the commentaries say, this is what's meant by the actual ultimate emptiness, the actual ultimate lack of essence is the thoroughly established. That is the object of observation for purification. When we're really completely meditating on emptiness in the mind-only tradition, it's meditation on the thoroughly established character, which is the ultimate absence of essence. Then we have a little metaphor here, as usual. The ultimate lack of own being should be viewed as being something other than those first two characters. For example, Paramarthasamugata, just as space is distinguished by being just the lack of own being of forms in space, and as pervading everywhere, in the same way the ultimate lack of own being is distinguished by being the selflessness of phenomena and should be viewed as all-pervasive and unitary, so, like space. The ultimate lack of own being is the absence of the imputational. Space lacks forms. Space is empty of forms. So this ultimate absence is like space. Thinking of those three types of lack of own being, I taught all phenomena lack of own being. So when I said all phenomena lack of own being, I was thinking of all three of these. Paramarthasamugata, thinking of lack of own being in terms of character, I taught all phenomena are unproduced, unceasing, quiescent from the start, and so on. Why is this? That which does not exist by way of its own character is not produced. In other words, the water in the mirage, it's not produced. It never existed in the first place. And what is not produced doesn't cease.
So now
obviously
he's repeating again, right?
Yeah.
The form of this thing?
Yeah. It's just repeating that the imputational character is in a state of nirvana, interestingly. It's like it doesn't arise and cease. Therefore, we could kind of say in this sort of weird kind of way, even though it's not the ultimate, it's definitely not the ultimate emptiness, the imputational character, right? Our imputations of things can't be ultimate emptiness, but it is empty in terms of actual characteristics. And so therefore we say that actually our imputations are in a state of nirvana. Imputational character is in a state of nirvana, which just means that nirvana literally means like cessation. So it never arose, never ceased. It has this nirvanic quality, which is kind of funny to talk about the imputational character that way. But he doesn't say this about, as you'll notice, about the other dependent character. That's not in a state of nirvana, of peaceful cessation, because it's arising. Mm-hmm. It's all this stuff. It's one bright pearl. Mm-hmm. It's not just nothing. So he skips that one and it goes on to the ultimate lack of own being is distinguished by being the selflessness of phenomena, therefore it's obviously in a state of nirvana, free from all afflictions. So this part about the other dependent not being ultimate non-natures. Just to emphasize this point again, because I think this is maybe the hardest part of this chapter. This section is called Other Power Natures as Ultimate Non-Natures. Right, so why other dependent character being a lack of own, an ultimate lack of own being, right? That's the weird part here. And he quotes that part of the sutra and then says, since other power natures are not what is observed and cognized in order to become purified of the obstructions to enlightenment, they are not the ultimate. Only the thoroughly established nature, or emptiness, is the ultimate. Therefore, other power natures are said to be without the nature of the ultimate. They are ultimate non-natures.
Why are they not objects for purification?
He will say that here in a nicer way than I could say it. The suggestion is that beings usually take phenomena that arise in dependence upon causes and conditions, other dependent, right, to be final, as if there were nothing beyond them. By pointing out that these are not ultimates, Buddha is calling attention to a more profound reality, as well as a conflict between appearance and reality.
Could you say that again?
By pointing out that these are not the ultimate, other dependent, Buddha is calling attention to a more profound reality, as well as a conflict between appearance and reality. Mm-hmm. You could say other dependent is like the mirage and appearance, and reality is like that there's no water there at all.
Well, the thing that's confusing to me is, as we've talked about, in a way, contemplation or meditating on other dependent is sort of easier because we can start to, it sort of unravels itself because we see the other dependent nature of things.
Yeah, yeah.
So that to me points to the absolute emptiness of that other dependent.
Yeah.
That's why I feel confused.
Yeah. It is a kind of emptiness. Somewhat purifying. And I think the Buddha might even use that kind of language. They're purified of some afflictions, but not all, because this more subtle way that language and conceptualization is constructing our world is much deeper and more subtle than just like things depend on other things, right? And it's all pervasive. Every moment where the imputational character is constructing an essential world. So I think it's somewhat purifying, but the most subtle delusions need to be purified with the thoroughly established.
The key is that it says it's not an object of purification.
Well, it is actually an object. Oh,
the ultimate
is the ultimate object.
That's
another issue that, is emptiness an object? There's quite a bit of discussion on this. Mm-hmm. But it's not obviously not an inherently existent object, but it's the object for meditation. It's a meditative object you can focus on. So other powered natures are not only natureless in terms of self-production, but are also natureless in terms of the ultimate. The reason for the latter is that only a final object of observation... let me skip this part here. Only through observing thoroughly established natures and meditating upon them are obstructions removed. This being because... Okay, this is the clincher here. This is a punchline. For me, this worked. Only through observing thoroughly established natures and meditating upon them are obstructions removed. This being because when taking emptiness to mind, the mind is engaged in a mode of apprehension explicitly contradictory to conceiving self or inherent existence.
Right.
This is what I mentioned the other day about explicit versus implicit.
Say that again? Slowly. Please.
When taking emptiness to mind, and we're talking about the particular emptiness of the thoroughly established here, the mind is engaged in a mode of apprehension explicitly contradictory to conceiving an essence or self.
Mm-hmm. The mind can function in this meditation in a way that is contradictory to its usual way of apprehending itself.
Yes, that's
capable of
nicely put. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's I think the thing about explicit is it's focusing on the exact point of where we're holding, which we talked about this before with Kathy, right? That like we go right to the place of the delusion, which is called the imputational adhering to the other dependent. That's where the thoroughly established is happening right there. It's not just like this abstract like emptiness. No, it's like right where we're like actually grasping. The place of grasping is the place of release. And emptiness is the absence of that particular adherence. So it's explicitly, it's contradictory, meaning it's the exact opposite. And whereas other dependent co-arising, I would say is, I don't know if he says it, but I would say is implicitly contradictory to grasping. Because when we see emptiness, that implies also dependent co-arising in a way, but it's not directly opposite. So if you just meditate on how things are dependently co-arising, it's we need this like a laser beam of awareness to focus exactly on the point, and it's dependent co-arising, even though it's right there, it's very close, it's like it's not zooming in on the right where we're grasping and seeing how it's not happening. It's not, grasping's not actually happening there. We might not see that in just like dependent co-arising.
Well, as I've seen my own delusion through this class, it's occurred to me that dependent co-arising actually creates things. The idea of dependent co-arising requires different things to exist so they can depend on each other. And it reifies the myriad things just to grasp the idea of things co-arising with things.
Yeah, it's about arising.
You cannot get past that assumption of things depending on each other, even temporarily, that this idea of emptiness is that one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not that there's not stuff happening, mm-hmm. it's just that suchness is free from dependent co-arising.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Like another example that was just what you're saying that I thought of the other day is that the Heart Sutra says all dharmas are marked by, or have the characteristic, actually it's the same word, lakshana, of emptiness. All dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease. So they don't arise. Dependent arising is all about arising. Think, you know, not substantial things, but it's still arising. In emptiness, there's no arising. Therefore ceasing. And that's why it's like all this negation. For example, since one form of the conception of the essence of things is to conceive that objects are established by way of their own character as the referent of a conceptual consciousness. If you haven't heard that language, just never mind, but it's a nice way of putting it, I think. A practitioner needs to meditate on objects' non-establishment in this way. One must meditate on the emptiness of such establishment. It's not sufficient merely to concentrate on other dependent natures, for through observing and thereupon meditating on other dependent natures, one cannot remove obstructions by engaging in a mode of apprehension that's explicitly contradictory to conceiving an essence. This is simply because one's not paying attention to the opposite of what ignorance misconceives in objects. Right, so this is what we've been saying. One must realize the absence, in bold print, of objects being established by way of their own character as the reference of words and conceptual consciousnesses. The sutra's clear statement that other powered natures are not the object of observation for purifying obstructions and hence not the ultimate is contrary to a notion currently prevalent among certain Japanese, American, and other scholars that the thoroughly established nature is just a purified version of the other dependent nature. Because some of the language really makes it sound that way. But if you read the language carefully, it's saying it's the actual absence of this in this, as opposed to when this is absent, this is I think in Bhakti Bandhu's 30 verses, we have the he brings up these three natures, and then he says absence of, I think the language is like the one prior to it in a verse, but he's saying the absence of the previously mentioned character is always the thoroughly established character. So you can hear that and think like, well, then this, it's, without that, then the other dependent just becomes the thoroughly established.
You take it away, and what's left is to know.
Yeah.
It's the fact that it's not even there.
Exactly. It's a very subtle difference, and so subtle that all these Yogacara scholars actually missed that point. That being said, still, the other dependent, or dependent co-arising and emptiness are, that we're talking about how they're not the same, but they're also not different. And you can read the first four chapters of the sutra that talk about the relationship of these two truths and how they're not exactly the same, but they're also not different. They're complete. The conventional truth and the ultimate truth, which we could call the dependent co-arising and the thoroughly established.
So there are no footprints in the thoroughly established.
There's no footprints. Yeah. And then he goes into why single out the other dependent natures as ultimate non-natures. Like we might ask, why didn't the Buddha say that the imputational nature is also an ultimate lack of own being? And he says the current theory is that because nobody would think that imputational natures are like the object of observation for purification.
Yeah, that's obvious.
That's obvious, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the other dependent is not so obvious. Because it's just to make that very point that he says there's two kinds of ultimate lack of own being. It's a little bit clunky way that the sutra does this, I think, but without much explanation. But that's what's going on. Oh, and actually we're past time. So you can read the rest of the chapter yourself. It basically just keeps going on with that point. There's nothing really new. So much more in addition to that. It's just about these three lacks of own being. And if you have the sutra, the rest of the chapter is quite wonderful, I think, also. Yes?
I was on the farm, definitely with my niece, who's 6 years old, and we saw three kinds of snakes, and she was thrilled. We saw the wooden snake we bought at the toy store put out to scare away the bunny. We saw a real snake by surprise. We were looking for apple blossoms. There was a real snake. And then we found a snake skin that some bugs were eating. We saw three kinds of snakes.
So which is which?
We've also seen three kinds of snakes.
That's great.
In a way, yeah. The wooden's like the imputational snake. The what we call the actual snake. Ah, yeah, so she wasn't fooled by it.
No.
And then the moving snake is like the other dependent, and the skin is like kind of the absence of a snake, right? It's like the snake left. Very nice concluding story. So, thank you for being so diligent and concentrated to put up with this. And we lost a few people along the way, but there's a... You know, I'm impressed that y'all kept coming in. And this is maybe as challenging a dharma, particularly in a sutra, maybe you'll ever hear. So, and I think you kind of got the full overview of this Yogacara school with all the consciousnesses and everything. It really, that's what it's about.
I have to say that...
Quickly, right?
That these themes have been coming up in everyday living to be constant. Very convenient.
Wonderful. Yeah, may we keep meditating on this stuff. And we dedicate the merit arising from this gathering to the complete awakening of all beings, distinguishing these three characteristics and non-natures for the benefit of all. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them.
Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. And Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become him.